be the greatest jobs president that God ever created. I'll take them back from China, from Japan, from Mexico. Ford is building a $2.5 billion factory, car plant, manufacturing plant for cars, trucks, and parts in Mexico.
How do you keep them?
You put a penalty on, a tariff, or whatever you call it. And believe me, China's doing it to us. China dumps all their stuff with us, and I'm not complaining about that, but I have friends that are manufacturers. They cannot get their product into China. So if they're going to do it to us, we have to do it to them.
And they'll say, but then my car's going to cost more for your people.
No, you know what? They're going to make cars here. And maybe a person will buy fewer cars over the course of a lifetime. Who cares?
Proposals that if you're trying to move jobs out of America, if you've ever gotten one penny of government aid, and lots of places have, you're going to have to pay it all back. And if you are trying to move your headquarters overseas in this, you know, thing called an inversion that I call a perversion, we're going to slap a big exit tax on you. So I think we do have to, you know, really bear down on companies that are picking up and moving and try to do everything we can
to stop eating our lunch. When people talk about free trade, like you just say, oh, that's tariff, that's... Well, I don't mind a tariff on a country that's got billions and billions of dollars of surplus. We are rebuilding China. We're rebuilding China because we order so much. We're so big. We're ordering so much product from them. You go over to China.
China.
China. China.
China.
China.
China.
China.
China.
China.
You take China.
China.
China. I love them. China.
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 China. I have to have my China. 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 Because China.
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 Now.
China.
China.
Hey, everyone. This is Carlos Morales, and this is the Libertarian Atheist Podcast. Find everything at libertarian-atheist.com. And, of course, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, whichever other podcast app you are particularly using. I'd like to thank everyone who's donating to the show right now. That is an expanding amount, but you know, the more the better. Honestly, I'm trying to build up a studio in California and get things going. And so you can donate at libertarian-atheist.com/donate. You can, you know, subscribe to give a certain amount of federal dollars per month, or you can also donate a Bitcoin. If there's another alt currency that you're looking into, feel free to message me and I'd like to work something out with you. And on that note, I have Andrew Cashone on the show today. We're going to be talking about free trade. So enjoy. Hey everyone, this is Carlos Morales. I am joined by Andrew Cashone, who is a good friend of mine, and he's also part of Feet, as well as the Bastiat Institute. And I wanted to have him on partly because it's actually the best time to actually catch up with my friends, is essentially to just have them on the show, but also to kind of talk about free trade as a whole, because the political circus of the 2016 election has kind of revived and reinvigorated popular belief in age-old protectionist fallacies. I mean, Trump, Sanders, who's kind of out now because he totally sold out to Hillary, but Hillary also, they're all in favor of expanding protectionist trade policies, from, you know, trying to instill more tariffs to just basically punishing corporations and companies as a whole for moving jobs overseas. They state that free trade destroys jobs. And it's kind of a zero-sum view of economics. Trade is not win-win, but rather win-lose. Me becoming richer means someone else is becoming poorer. Now, from Trump, it's a rather Marxist position for the supposed demigod of capitalism. And of course, the politicians who want more and more power are wrong, including the celebrities who want more and more power. But it doesn't mean that the support for these fallacious positions isn't growing like a cancer across the country. Now, Andrew, do you find it to be true necessarily? And this is the reason why I'm having you on the show, because obviously you have a pretty good understanding of free trade and economics as a whole, that competition between domestic and foreign workers may lead in a decline in wages?
No, not across the board, but it is certainly true for some particular industries. And to kind of, on the small scale, it's very easy to picture that suppose you have an island and you blow up the bridge to the island, so suddenly the island's cut off from trade. Now, this is going to make the island poorer, everyone on the island poor, except maybe there are a few people who might win from this. Maybe the local carpenter might actually be able to increase his wages if the bridge is blown out and they can't access more carpenters on the mainland. And the similar thing happens with international trade, where when large tariff walls go up, the country as a whole loses, but there are sometimes particular industries that benefit. And this is brought up mostly in Bastiat's famous parable of the candlemakers petition, where the candlemakers all get together to shut out the cheap foreign competition that's flooding the market with cheap, light competition goods and putting them all out of business. So they want to increase their wages, and they get together and they try to ban sunlight in France. That's Bastiat's famous candlemakers petition essay. And when you think about it, yeah, the candlemakers probably could raise their wages if there was a law passed that mandated everyone close all their windows during the day and that everyone pay taxes if they're not using candles. It might help the candlemakers. It would probably destroy the economy as a whole. But this is Bastiat's great example of tariffs where, you can sometimes make a case for a particular workers in an industry that wages can stay higher if you put up huge tariffs. And similarly with automation, that some wages do get brought down or jobs go obsolete from automation. But this philosophy of being anti-trade makes everyone poorer, even if there are a few jobs, and I think it's less than most people assume, actually, that may see small wage decreases or may the job might disappear when you have trade. Or conversely, it's really the same argument for automation. So that's my general understanding of it.
Yeah, I mean, so in the short term, you may get lower wages in certain areas, but it's compensated by lowering the prices of goods and services, which can now be freely imported from abroad. So it's not just about wages, right? It's also about what those wages can buy. And there's kind of a technology gap that's actually getting smaller and smaller. So I, for instance, can afford to buy the same phone as Donald Trump right now, right? Even though he's a lot more rich than I am, apparently on paper, I'm not totally sure, but I imagine he is. I mean, I know banks can loan him out a shit ton more money because he's built up credit. So even though, you know, 30 years ago, I couldn't even imagine owning a cordless home phone for less than, hundreds of dollars adjusted for inflation. So the amount the dollar actually gets you as far as technology and quality advancements is staggering and monumental. And, you know, for all the disaster scenarios that doomsday forecasters enjoy promoting, life is pretty good right now, especially when you consider that a good 60 to 70% of our income is plundered by the nanny state through not only taxes, but inflation as a whole. And blaming something like inflation or issues with taxes on free trade, I think it's a bit like blaming the sale of ice cream on the amount of, shark attacks, right? It's not directly correlated, right?
Yeah,
it's correlated, but not causative.
Yeah, there's countries around the world that aren't part of this neoliberal free trade, if you want to call it neoliberal, but the general philosophy that tariffs should be brought lower, that many, if not most, countries today are adopting, sometimes in misguided methods of free trade treaties, which we'll get into later. But there are countries that are still very mercantilistic, that put up large tariffs in order to shut out foreign competition and supposedly create jobs domestically. These countries. So Brazil is probably the best example. And Brazil is not a socialist country. It's a market-oriented economy in comparison to Venezuela or countries which are really absolute train wrecks. But despite the fact that Brazil is a market economy, it has very high tariffs, and I think this does enormous amounts of damage. So just to get an idea of this, a PlayStation 4 in America, and this is a couple years ago, but was retailing at about $300, $400, and in Brazil it was $1,800, with the difference being entirely due to import taxes, tariffs. And then this is a PlayStation, but everything in the electronics world is the same story, where Brazilians are paying four or five, sometimes more, times the price that an American or a person in a low tariff country would pay. And I think this is one of the main economic drags on Brazil, that they kind of should be a success story. Everything else is kind of there except the free trade. And I think the tariffs are really why I mean, things like why you see all these problems with the Olympics. Really, when you have the Olympics in a poor country that hasn't quite made it to first world status, there's just no good way to run the Olympics. You're going to have insane infrastructure problems and all that. It's a wealth problem. And Brazil is a much poorer country than it would be if it had lower tariffs. There are not insane amounts of Brazilian PlayStation jobs being created to take away from the fact that Sony PlayStation is stealing the jobs. It doesn't happen in the real world. Countries really can't bring manufacturing back by increasing tariffs. It's never worked. And the countries that still kind of try that mercantilist philosophy today suffer extremely for it. Luckily, there's not a lot. India used to be a very mercantilist country like Brazil, but it is adopting lower tariffs over the last 20 to 30 years. And that's one of the reasons you've seen such a spectacular rise in the standard of living in India over the last 20 to 30 years.
Yeah. And a lot of times whenever people do show India, they do show the most destitute areas. And it is catastrophically destitute in many areas. I mean, true poverty where people can't even afford clothes to be able to put on their backs. And they're living in absolute filth. And that is an atrocious situation. But for me, you know, you always have to kind of look at the historical context of what's going on. I cannot wait for things to get better in those areas, but it doesn't mean it's not getting better in specific ways. And there's certainly a lot of data that, though people, for the most part, think the world is getting worse and worse, it seems to be getting better and better. And it is a fuming type of religiosity that is integral to progressivist arguments that... You know, we are, we're a product of original sin. We pollute and we destroy and we pillage. And that's why we have to restrict freedom completely. And it's interesting because the anti-free trade argument, as you brought up, is kind of a regressive Ludditism. And that was really prevalent in the early 1900s due to fear of the rising third world or migrants coming in. So, you know, the anti-free trade argument was deeply connected to the anti-immigration argument. It was progressivism. You know, the same people who created the statist indoctrination, soul-crushing public education system, along with the eugenics movement and the military-industrial complex, were some of the biggest proponents of anti-trade policies. And though, you know, Alex Jones and Trump, you know, their whole crew throw around the term globalist when they discuss these psychopaths, their rhetoric, you know, it mirrors that of early progressives. Though, you know, kind of with the eloquence of baboons and, you know, vacuousness of NASCAR enthusiasts. But overall, it is a lack of understanding of what free trade means on a lot of their arguments. You know, for instance, I don't really consider the TPP, a Trans-Pacific Partnership, for people who want to look it up. I don't really see how, you know, thousands and thousands of pages of paperwork is exactly free trade. So just because you're not pro-TPP or pro-NAFTA, doesn't mean you're not, you know, for a form of free trade. And obviously the government is monumentally involved in all trade, in part because the government kind of created what is the corporation. But overall, even within a government-based system, the freer trade you have, the better. So if you wanted to deviate from and remove a lot of the outside mitigating factors, like, say, like race and genetics and culture and everything else, and you just looked at, say, North Korea and South Korea, one obviously is developing quicker than, I mean, even America in certain ways. The amount of internet they have, the technological buildup, the higher life expectancy. You know, they're getting huge growth in life in general, right? In progress, and they're freely trading with a number of other countries. And North Korea, same exact people. You know, they're one of the worst, most destitute countries in the entire world, and a lot of that has directly to do with whether or not they are trading or not.
And so South Korea is a great example of how quickly countries can actually become rich. The history of South and North Korea is both of them were bombed into oblivion during the Korean War, and they didn't really rebuild till about 30 years after that is when South Korea actually started having some good pro-market policies and industrializing. But up until the late 70s, you could arguably make the case that South and North Korea had about the same like wealth per capita. They're very poor countries. And then very rapidly in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, South Korea industrialized. They adopted enough pro-market policies. And now I think they're richer per capita than the U.S. I'll have to double check that number. But countries can, in the space of a few decades, turn things around. As depressing as like Venezuela is looking now, if they got some good leadership in there, you know, the opposition, who knows, in a couple decades, they could be another shining success story like South Korea. Countries, and furthermore, you can have a first world country like Venezuela used to be the richest or one of the richest countries in Latin America, and now it's just an absolute disaster. So countries, depending on how pro-trade and pro-market their policies are, they could rapidly see changes in the standard of livings that only take a few decades nowadays to carry out. So it's not like countries are forever poor or forever rich. They can fairly rapidly change their status in this regard if they just adopt certain policies.
Yeah, and it's interesting that, you know, people like Slate Magazine and Huffington Post aren't really redacting their articles where they stated that Venezuela was, you know, going to be this booming, amazing economy due to socialist policies, right? Instead, they're now saying, oh, well, it's destitute and everything else because they were still de facto corporatist communist, or it's because the United States is making oil cheaper. So it's a lack of acknowledgement that central planning is one of the biggest issues with this. You know, saying, for instance, the oil curse, right? Whenever a country has a lot of oil, therefore they're totally screwed, isn't necessarily true. It's more a matter of, okay, now are we going to centrally plan the entire economy based around this one specific thing, right? Now, specialization isn't in and of itself a bad thing, but having a lot of different lines of production as far as exporting and importing goods is generally beneficial, right? It's the old adage, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Although I hate that adage anyway, because why would you not put a lot of eggs in one basket? I don't want to carry around a bunch of baskets. That's a stupid fucking saying. Anyway, I digress. By the way, if you can tell, I've had a lot of coffee today. but when it comes to, you know, understanding that kind of aspect of isn't necessarily a curse, Norway is a perfect example of where the situation can get much worse quickly. And then get much better by the lacking of or the lowering of regulations. Could you expand a bit on kind of what happened with Norway when it came to oil?
Yeah. So Norway didn't have any oil, well, that they knew about until about 1967. They struck oil. And in 1967, Norway was a very capitalist, very first world, one of the wealthiest countries in the world. Over the next 10 years after they struck oil, the government went on a spending spree, and Norway started turning into Venezuela really rapidly, modern Venezuela. The government just started expanding, becoming more and more socialist. The economy was collapsing. And this was a very rapid change. It was really, you know, the government went nuts with the oil revenue and was in the process of just third worldizing the country. And then in the mid-70s or so, kind of the neoliberals, the free marketers, the Friedman and Hayek fans gained power in Norway, and they instituted some pro-market reforms. They did things like, instead of just giving the government all the oil revenue as a lump sum and having it distribute it to its cronies, they did things like establish a oil fund that's traded on the stock market, a stat oil kind of incorporating market prices. They did a lot of things that Friedman and Hayek suggested. They didn't have any price fixing, which is a main part of it. So if you look at their economies nowadays, you can say, oh, the Venezuelan economy and the Norwegian economy, the state controls about the same percentage of the economy in both countries. But this isn't really accurately looking at the situation. What you have in Norway is very low levels of price controls and regulation. And so kind of the economy can survive with a lot of oil and a big state oil fund. In Venezuela, you don't have any of this. You have huge price fixing. The state doesn't have any sort of exchange-traded oil fund that has market principles built in. It's completely just distributed to cronies. And you, as soon as the oil price dips a few cents, you have everyone in the country starving to death. So
go ahead. You can finish up.
I was just going to say, it depends on how you manage the oil. Although even with Norway managing the oil very kind of in a capitalist manner now, still, I would say the oil made Norway poorer. It would have been much richer if they never struck oil at all. So I do think the research curse has a little bit of a truth to it. Is, yeah, typically in the low resource regions of the world, They end up being wealthier. You know, Hong Kong, Switzerland, they don't have resources just because the government doesn't have this massive money chest to kind of expand with. Kind of, you don't want to strike oil in your country, especially if you have a government that is not very capitalist.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting, too, if you think about what can kind of happen whenever you do have a lot of resources immediately. So, for instance, one of the arguments for kind of how we kind of civilization slightly sprang up is that human beings started moving to areas that didn't necessarily have a lot of food, right? Like colder areas as a whole, but also, you know, with an expanding population, you need more long-term planning in order to be able to live and expand, right? In which one of the most important things for human beings to do, or just beings in general, is to reproduce. So you want to make sure that, you know, your kids aren't starving and you're not starving. So, you know, the Northerners, or people who moved out of Africa, they had an expansion of IQ because they had to start thinking about what are the long-term things if it's going to start freezing over. So rather than living in abundance, where when you're in an abundant situation, you don't really have to whenever you're in an abundant situation, you don't have to worry about things like planning as a whole. It's interesting, though, because that can almost get you into a conversation of, you know, therefore, is it bad if a country then gets a bunch of free stuff or a bunch of things get dumped onto them, right?
So, oh, yeah, that's a great point to loop that back into tariffs here with the argument that China's subsidizing all these cheap goods, sending it to America, and Americans are kind of becoming welfare rats en masse, that we're getting all this very cheap subsidized stuff from China and we don't know how to produce anything anymore. And it's kind of like, you know, people in an inner city that are getting food stamps, and economists generally agree this doesn't actually help the economic situation when you have large welfare states. Is the situation with Chinese trade now similar to that at all? And if so, is that an excuse for raising tariffs? Because that seems to be a big argument for tariffs that I always run into, is, oh, well, China is subsidizing their goods and sending them to us artificially cheap. So, of course, we need tariffs to defend our industry against that.
Yeah.
And I think even in these kind of worst case dire situations where, and I don't think this actually happens as much as people say, where we're just getting free stuff the Chinese taxpayers are paying for. But let's assume that this is actually happening in an industry, maybe steel. And the Obama administration pretty much said this is happening to some degree in steel the other week. And so they're going to start putting tariffs, retaliatory tariffs on steel. But if this is true and China is really sending just boatloads of free steel to America, or heavily discounted steel, is this an argument for the U.S. to kind of put tariffs up and stop it? And I think it's not. And here's my logic. Going back to Bastiat's Candlemaker's Petition, where we have an enormous foreign producer who's dumping cheap, you know, want to call it subsidized stuff off at very low cost, and it's hurting domestic candle producers. Well, this foreign producer is the sun, and the sun doesn't, you know, yeah, it costs some jobs, I suppose, but it helps us overall. And I think cheap goods kind of always help us. If free laptops started kind of raining down from the heavens, the way to look at this would not be like, holy crap, we're going to lose all of our laptop jobs, this is awful, the economy is going to be... It's like, no, there's free laptops raining out of the sky, who knows why, but enjoy it. I think that the problem you have with welfare has to do with centralization and incentive systems being built up to keep you poor, because you lose your welfare if you get richer. It has to do with things like the government crowding out the market economy, the economic calculation problem, and the government's inability to calculate. I actually don't see these problems happening with just cheap goods.
Certainly with that. I mean, there's a specific term. I think it's called like the wealth drop or something like that. But essentially, like let's say you're a woman in New York who has, you know, four kids, and you're only making $18,000 a year. Well, you can get all of these massive benefits, housing benefits, food stamps, a lot of other things that actually bring up your wealth kind of to about anywhere from $40,000 to $50,000. So as soon as you make more than $18K and you get into that $20K bracket, suddenly you're much poorer than you were when you were making $18K. So you need to compensate by making you know, almost 140% more money in order to just make up for where you were at with all of that subsidization. And that kind of creates that whole poverty continuation. And that's a really, really unfortunate thing. And this is how you kind of have to separate when you're thinking of how the government kind of destroys our lives in general. It doesn't matter even if there's a good intention to it. It seems like the things where there is a lot of good intention almost end up generally the worst. I mean, Child Protective Services is the perfect case of this. And it's always confusing to know whether or not the intention is legitimately good or if it's bad. It's all about control. To me, it doesn't really matter. The effects matter, right? I can have all the good intentions in the world and, you know, blow up a kid with a drone. The kid doesn't really give a fuck about my intentions overall. Now, intentions to a certain extent can matter as far as, like, what are the kind of things that someone will do in the future? Like, if my intent is to just kill kids and I accidentally do it, then there's a or I do it on purpose and people know that the reason why I'm doing this is to kill children, then you have a lot more to be worried about. But all in all, when I think about how the government has enacted its force through economic and political ways throughout its entire history, I can only... there's no way for me to think positively that the government has our best interests, or even if it had our best interests in mind whatsoever, could positively impact my life by controlling it more through things like trade barrier as a whole. Now, the history of free trade, though, has been quite an interesting one, because, I mean, countries have been trading with each other for, you know, centuries. But, like, large-scale trade has come with, you know, some benefits, but, you know, some negatives as a whole. And Britain was kind of a proof of that. I mean, when the British talked about free trade, they essentially meant that trade was to be unimpeded with Britain, lest we bring, you know, ships and things like that to kind of destroy your lives. And this happened with India. It happened with China, and that kind of led to the Opium Wars, where Britain wanted to trade with China because there was a lot of goods that China had that Britain did not have, right? For instance, you know, like silk, porcelain, and tea. And it kind of created this imbalance because China didn't really have a want for Western goods, or at least that's kind of what the dictators at the time suggested. So what Britain did in response, because they wanted these other goods, was flood the market. Well, Britain and the Dutch East Indian Company flooded the Chinese market with opium, got them highly addicted to it in order to be able to generate at least currency coming into the country so they could kind of expand trade. And then, you know, China finally got fed up. They ended up, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, it was 20,000 chests of opium the Chinese government ended up taking from them, which was about 2.6 million tons of, 2.6 million pounds of opium from the British, and the British went ahead and did gunboat diplomacy, grabbed up a bunch of naval ships, and blew the hell out of a bunch of Chinese boats. That led to the Treaty of Nanking, which granted the, you know, indemnity to the Brits, which opened up ports and trade. So a lot of times trade has been mixed in with conquest. And
it's very similar to the U.S. story. Actually, as you're telling me to that, I'm realizing how similar that story is to the founding of America, where you had the tea. So the British pretty much were offloading all this tea into America that was kind of a surplus. And all the American local tea producers were really mad because this was stealing their jobs or whatever. And so they're the ones who kind of organized the Tea Party and the mass resistance to that. And so, you know, they destroyed millions and millions of pounds of British tea, and then the British pretty much did gunboat diplomacy to try to force America back into its, you know, exclusive monopoly trading partner. And then the Americans actually won, unlike the Chinese. So, it's almost the exact same story, China and early America.
Yeah, and I mean, to be fair, since World War I, America has taken to British forms of international relations, yeah, dealing with other countries. I mean, you go ahead and you assault a lot of the groups within a country in order to expand your power by getting the most maniacal, psychopathic individuals to be the heads of specific tribes. And then if, you know, they end up electing a leader who they don't like, you assassinate them so you can expand trade in specific ways. And, you know, I certainly cannot make a positive argument for that form of diplomacy, but I cannot throw out voluntary exchange of goods because sometimes the exchange of goods are violent, right?
Yeah, and I'd just like to put some kind of theory in here because it does kind of seem like we're stuck in these hopeless paradoxes where we like trade, but we hate, you know, the empires and trade treaties that seem to correlate with them. Well, you know, make up our mind. What's your position? But I think there is a logic to this argument that you should both be for trade and against kind of these super state corresponding structures that often correlate with trade, such as empires and these large free trade treaties. And I can go into my logic a little bit here.
Go for it.
Yeah, so pretty much I think the correlation between imperialism and trade, it makes a lot of sense when you stop and think about it, in that Venezuela is not about to invade Iraq. It can barely pay its police force. North Korea is not about to invade Iraq. It can barely, you know, feed its military officers. The U.S. can invade Iraq. You know, England can invade Iraq. Modern capitalist countries, which are very wealthy, and they're very wealthy because they have low tariffs and, you know, a capitalist market, they're the only countries that can really, you know, expand their borders, conquer other countries militarily, overthrow coups with advanced modern coup techniques and well-funded intelligence. Like, you know, it's wealth is what wins wars. Wealth is what determines whether one country wins or loses in a conflict, or whether an empire is able to expand and conquer territory. And market-based capitalist pro-trade countries are just much, much wealthier than small protectionist socialist states, and it's really not even a contest. And so I'm not saying it's morally justified for capitalist countries to go around invading socialist countries. I'm just saying that kind of this is what happens. You know, countries are going to invade whoever they can get away with invading, every country, but the only ones that can really get away with invading anywhere are the capitalist, modern, wealthy ones. And so, you know, it's just something to recognize that this is kind of how history tends to play out. But then with the added nuance that modern trade policy isn't, it's still done to some extent with old-fashioned imperialism. But there's this new third thing, which is the free trade treaties that have kind of gained popularity over the last century. So we could talk about that a little as well, because they're not traditional imperialism where you just have a country marching in and conquering small countries. It is somewhat consent-based, maybe less so than they market it as, but I still think they're problematic.
I would like to point out something too, and this kind of is an aside a little bit, but it has to do with trade sanctions, right? Like if you don't like a specific country, you then do trade sanctions where you kind of punish that country and you end up punishing a lot of people for if they trade with them whatsoever. And it's considered like soft diplomacy by, you know, kind of neocons and progressives as a whole. You know, it's not full-out war, but it generally leads to a lot more deaths than just straight-up battles where you go straight, you know, for trying to kill specific whatever bad people, however you want to, you know, call them. But whenever you create trade sanctions, it actually hurts the poor the most, because the poor cannot make up for not being able to get these goods, right? It's kind of like I'd rather be a lower middle class person in a semi-capitalist country than a rich person in the communist country, because at least there's some kind of goods coming in. But when it comes to trade sanctions as a whole, we know how disastrous that can be, which is even more proof of why not trading in this global economy is a completely catastrophic move. And it, I mean,
especially,
because the thing is that certain countries are going to specialize in specific types of production, and it ends up lowering the cost for creating those specific goods. And if it doesn't lower the cost, then you don't do it in that specific country. It's called comparative advantage. It's kind of important. It's why you should be getting your sugar from Cuba if you're living in Florida, rather than getting your sugar from Florida if you're in Florida, because the climate is makes way, way more sense to do it there than it does here.
It's opportunity cost. So, like, let's suppose that Florida actually can produce sugar for a couple cents cheaper than Cuba. I don't actually think this is true, but just suppose maybe due to automation that you actually can produce sugar for a few cents cheaper in Florida than Cuba. Should you make your sugar in Florida? Well, what is the opportunity cost of the land? The opportunity cost of the land in Florida are like multi-million dollar golf course condos. You know, like, there's a lot of people who want land in Florida and are willing to put down a lot of money for it. Cuba, not so much. In fact, sugar is kind of one of the only industries they have going. So it's comparative advantage. Even if Florida has an absolute advantage, which I don't think is actually true, you still can have a comparative advantage where it just makes no sense to grow the sugar in Florida, just like it makes no sense to grow the sugar in Hong Kong, even if Hong Kong might be a great climate for growing sugar. It's just, no, they need the land for more important things like skyscrapers. It's comparative advantage and opportunity cost. Even if you could grow sugar for a couple cents cheaper in Hong Kong, you wouldn't want to grow it there. And that's the difference between comparative advantage and absolute advantage, which is a tricky thing to kind of get. So if you understand it, hats off to you. Comparative advantage isn't the most intuitive concept, but it's very important to understanding these trade debates.
Yeah, well, it's you know, time. The term time is money is important, and certain people's time is worth more money than others, right? Like Bill Gates, you know, doing a specific, going to Goodwill and trying to sort out exactly which, you know, suit he should buy from Goodwill and having to go to six of them. He makes absolutely no sense compared to an impoverished person who does, whose time isn't worth a lot of money to do, right? Because Bill Gates could have made maybe thousands or tens of thousands of dollars in the same amount of time. So if you think of it as kind of, What is the particular person's time worth? That's where it kind of comes into mind, right? Like at the job I have right now, you know, I get, you know, it's maybe a certain amount of money an hour. And if I leave work early because I want to go get a specific good for cheaper, does it make sense for me to do that? Because in that amount of time, couldn't I have made twice as much money and then only had to spend maybe $2 more on that good during that specific time? I might not be explaining it the correct way, but I think it's kind of an easier way for people to kind
like
of
here.
Understand.
Here's my economics professor had an explanation where a dentist might be a better gardener than a gardener. He might just have a knack for it, but it still might not make sense for the dentist to do his gardening. You know, he still might want to hire a gardener, even if he's a great gardener, better than the gardener he hires. It's just, no, he's a dentist. He has more valuable things to be doing with his time. Even though he's a great gardener too, the dentistry is much more important than the gardening to him. And so he's going to hire a gardener. Even if he has an absolute advantage in gardening, he's still going to hire a gardener because of comparative advantage.
Yeah. And I think there is something to be said about, you know, the problems with specialization just on your psyche, though, right? Like, you want to be kind of a well-rounded individual, and by repeatedly just making one specific small part of the iPhone, you know, it can drive you nuts and possibly cause a bunch of hand issues and everything else. And we see this when we look at like industrialization building up in, say, the Pacific, in Bangladesh, all these other areas, you see this massive specialization to the point where they're treating people like automatons. And that's, you know, I completely agree that is an issue. But after a certain amount of time, the wealth increases more, and it expands and creates what is known as the middle class. The middle class wasn't something that was around 300 years ago, right? It was a product of the Industrial Revolution and the creation and expansion of wealth, in a large part due to massive amounts of trade. And that gave us a lot more kind of leisure and free time. And how we're choosing to use it really depends on us. And I would say that we'd certainly have a lot more free time if we were, say, the beginning of strong Roman civilization, where we only had to spend 2 days out of the year paying off all of our taxes, you know, in order to be able to get the government going, versus how the government is running right now, where when I think about work and how much, especially in the great state of California, how much money they grab from me, I mean, probably 60% of my job is just going to pay for a bloated government that does absolutely nothing for me.
Wow.
Right? Like when I really look at, you know, a paycheck that I'll get, whether it's through commission or, you know, just the base salary, It is astronomical how much money they're jacking from me. And then, you know, on top of that, besides that money right there, there's then the property tax on the place I'm living, and then the sales tax on top of that, and there's a federal and an income tax here. I mean, if when you put it all together, it is really, really horrifying. And you think, you know,
one of the reasons,
I think one of the best ways to sell, you know, more free market or just possibly just anarchist philosophy as a whole is, what could you do if you were twice as wealthy?
Yep.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why tariffs are so destructive is that, so suppose the government like reduced the income tax by 50% and then made tariffs very high to make up for that. Everyone would kind of be jumping up and down for joy that their own income tax went down. But it's a little harder to see that the government's still doing just as much damage because the price of goods is going to start rapidly going up when all these large tariffs are on. So it's the seen versus the unseen, kind of when the government's just taking money directly from you. It would be even more the case if you had to mail them a check once a year. That's a very seen, very visible. When the government kind of taxes up the production structure, taxes imports, does corporate taxation, etc., it's harder to see the actual cost of the government. And this is actually an argument maybe for some of those like Gary Johnson's nutty idea, the fair tax, I think, where it's collected as a sales tax. You just take the whole federal taxation collected as a sales tax. Like, you know, I'm not saying I support it, but I see the logic that it's very evident and plain, you know, that you're paying this money to the federal government. Whereas if they kind of switched over to maybe Trump's method where they have it all as tariffs and nothing as sales or income taxes, the taxation is more hidden and trickier to spot. So, similar with inflation, too, how inflation is a very hidden method of taxation. And so it's kind of bad for that reason, you know, alone, in addition to others, that the government, there's no real way for you to see how much money the government is stealing from you every day. And then you're less aggrieved, et cetera.
Yeah. And when it comes to inflation, yet again, just like massive trade barriers, it hurts the poor the most because they do not have the assets or the know-how to be able to, you know, switch around what they're putting money into or, you know, more information on as far as like forecasting is concerned. And it is one of the most egregious forms of real taxation that is going on. But I always have to just stress, and this is really, it was really insane. I was listening to Vox Day talk to Bob Murphy on Tom Wood's show regarding, it was a debate on free trade, and he like blamed the amount of work we have to do a week on free trade. And I was like, that's fucking insane. I mean, like, should we go back to an agrarian society before we started really spending a lot of times, you know, getting the free flow of information, thought, and goods as a whole? I certainly don't think that'd be a better situation. But, you know, Vox is also like, you know, white power kind of guy. So, you know,
a non-white power. Like, even if you believe it, like that white power stuff, it's like, yeah, white power, let's do all like the work that right now Mexicans are doing ourselves. Like, it doesn't even seem like the white power angle is logical. There's just no logic to it whatsoever.
Well,
like,
if you lower tariffs, there can be kind of an argument to be made that people are more likely to actually stay in the countries that they're in, because they can then continue to trade using comparative advantage from their country to your country, rather than having to move there in order to be able to get a job, and then, you know, they get hit by taxes or whatever else. And, you know, this is like another argument for, even if you're for, you know, the restriction of immigration, I would still say that free trade is still a better aspect for you, because if you're going to be building up a bunch of different countries, all of their economies are kind of rising up, there's going to be less incentive for them to then flood your specific culture as a whole, because their countries themselves are building up quite quickly. India is another case of this. And right now, for Mexicans as a whole, we're actually having net negative immigration, which is really, really funny. For Mexicans, but not for, you know, everyone as a whole. Middle Easterners are coming in more than ever, but yeah, it's just an interesting aspect. It all goes back to the unseen costs of how this all builds up, which is why, again, centrally planning is such a terrible idea.
Yeah, I mean, I'll make the point. I myself am fairly pro-immigration, but I think it's completely, you know, a position that if you hate immigrants, you can still be very pro-trade. You know, Japan, like, doesn't allow any immigrants in whatsoever, but they have fairly low tariffs nowadays. The two don't necessarily go together. So if you hate immigrants, don't get turned off for trade for that reason, because really it's two different issues.
Yeah, and it depends on who you're talking to as far as, like, if they are two separate issues. So, or if human beings are just goods who happen to own themselves, then the free flow of capital should also include the free flow of human beings.
Oh, human capital, I guess, yeah.
Yeah. Someone listened to my episode, for instance, on like the Syrian refugee thing, they would think that I'm this really hard borders person. My main argument is just do not subsidize behavior through theft, right? Because a lot of the things that we're getting, for instance, in places like Sweden, where you have the destruction of Malmo, a town there which I actually lived in for a bit. It was a mostly Jewish town, and now it's completely run by Muslim gangs. It's because, you know, these people didn't actually have to be a part of the marketplace, right? They didn't have to negotiate with people around the culture because they're being artificially subsidized. And by subsidizing specific communities rather than getting them to have to work within the community as a whole in order to be able to expand their wealth so that their kids can eat, you end up in the worst situation, which is why, you know, the immigration now is still different than the immigration that was in, say, the 1800s, early 1900s, where a lot of that was, I'm going to come here and I'm going to work. And there may or may not be an argument that some people are coming here so they can get free shit. And, I mean, that's certainly the case in areas of Europe where you have, you know, this huge amount of Muslims who are coming into, you know, Scandinavian countries where they had to go through a lot of different countries in order to get there, right? So it's not like they're not just refugees of war. It's because they also know they can get these benefits from coming to these places. Which, and, you know, I can't knock them. I can't knock people for wanting free stuff. It makes sense to a point. I think it kind of hurts your integrity and it hurts your will to thrive and live.
It's the opposite. Yeah, it's the opposite of like classical immigration. So like when you have Ludwig von Mises and the great kind of classical liberals and libertarians writing about immigration, for them, immigration is always kind of a method of moving despite the government that hurts the government, where if the government raises taxes too high in California, then you're going to have people and businesses moving out of California. You're going to have human flight and capital flight. And like, this is really actually the only thing that really produces liberty in Ludwig von Mises' eye, is that you have these competitive forces between governments that, you know, the only reason California hasn't raised taxes higher than they are already in California are because they're worried of the last few corporations moving to Texas. You know, they're worried about losing all their young workers. And this competitive force is kind of within government. This is the real good thing about, you know, for Mises, everything, both freedom of movement of capital, goods, and labor. But just talking about goods, it's very important to realize this fact, because this is actually one of my arguments against the TPP and these free trade treaties, that it's a great thing that you can buy goods from outside of the regime that you live in. So if I live in the U.S. and the U.S. has banned hemp production, I can buy industrial hemp from Canada. If I live in a country that has very high levels of regulation, and so the goods produced there are very expensive, I can buy goods from neighboring countries or countries around the world that have lower levels of regulation and buy them for cheaper. And you lose this, I think, with free trade treaties. And let me explain a little. Where what free trade treaties do is they destroy political comparative advantage, where in the current system, you might have some tariffs. They're fairly low nowadays, even going back to like the 19th century system where you had like a 50% across the board tariff. Yeah, you have a few different tariffs, but you can shop around for regimes. You know, you can choose to put your business in different regimes. You could choose to buy products from different regimes. And back then, it was kind of the age of open migration. You could choose to live in different regimes. But what free trade treaties do is they do regulatory harmonization. All of them, especially the newer ones, do this way more than the early ones. They make one set of regulations for every country within the treaty, and they try to enforce them on the main industries that are covered by the treaty. And so instead of having 12 different countries you can shop around in define the country with the best regulations, you have all the countries in the TPP will be adopting uniform regulatory frameworks. And if any country decides to go laissez-faire and deregulate, they can actually be sued in these private courts by companies for making their regulations too lax, which is unfair because that's dumping, right? Where if China has low levels of regulation and the U.S. has high levels of regulation, in the old system, this is great. We just buy things from China because they don't regulate themselves to death. In the new system, it's, oh, no, we're going to put a retaliatory anti-dumping tariff on China unless they adopt the same regulations the U.S. has. And these dumping tariffs are actually way higher than even the old 19th century tariffs where you'd have a 50% across-the-board tariff. For instance, if you look up the story of a candle tax, candle tariffs are way over 100% from China. The money that's collected from the tariff literally goes to domestic candle producers. It's the most crony capitalist thing ever. And it's this is what happens whenever they declare that the foreign country is dumping. They say, oh, you have too little regulation. You're producing things too cheaply. So we're going to put an anti-dumping retaliatory tariff on you of 100%, 150%, 200%. And so these free trade treaties, A, they kind of destroy political comparative advantage. B, they increase tariffs very often under the guise of dumping regulations on the most important goods. Because for me, the whole point of trade is buying cheaper things elsewhere that you can get at a lower price than you could within your country. That's the reason we trade. And so these trade agreements often are bad for free trade on those two grounds, and also on a third ground, which is that even though they might reduce tariffs within the members of the treaty, they often increase tariffs for abroad. So, for instance, the U.S. Constitution was really the first free trade treaty, and it lowered the tariffs within the states. So like Massachusetts and Rhode Island, they had an 8% tariff, and then the Constitution was put in, and they got rid of that 8% tariff, but it imposed a 50% tariff for trading outside the U.S. And so Massachusetts, under the Articles of Confederation, could trade with Canada at 8%, or they could trade with Connecticut at 8%. After the Articles of Confederation were abandoned and the Constitution was put in, Massachusetts could trade with Connecticut for free, but it could trade with Canada at a 50% tariff. The same things happened with the EU, where you might have lower tariffs now between Germany and Italy, but it's much harder for Italy to trade with Northern Africa than it was before the EU. And so those are three arguments where if you're a diehard hater of tariffs like I am, I hate tariffs, I think they're awful, but I still don't approve these free trade treaties, even though they do on face value seem wonderful. They're lowering all these tariffs, they're getting rid of tariffs, it's a great thing. I think a further look into them shows that they're kind of bad for free trade reasons alone.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I found it kind of important to kind of discuss this topic. You know, for the most part on this show, I don't really go too much into things like elections. I kind of like talking about bigger ideas than necessarily, you know, just party politics. And if Trump is really means what he says when he says these certain things, and does he mean what he means when he contradicts himself, and trying to understand what's going on in that end, or trying to, you know, take apart what's going on with the DNC right now, even though that is one of the greatest shit shows I've ever seen in my entire life. I mean, this is like, it is transparency towards an amazing level. And actually what's going, and just a side note, what's going on with the DNC and how much information is coming out right now about how, you know, the Washington Post was having a fundraiser with the DNC, and yeah, how they stated categorically that this is what we're going to do against Trump and everything else. This kind of proves slightly to me, at least, that more information isn't necessarily going to change a lot of people's minds, because they'll come up with any kind of rationalization whatsoever to keep their pre-existing notions, which is slightly, you know, that's a fatalistic, nihilistic kind of point of view. I'm not totally on that end. But I think just talking about the broader ideas is to me, it's certainly what brought me to libertarianism as a whole. More than trying to, you know, shit on specific politicians. And I want to bring more people to this philosophy, because I think it's one of, you know, voluntarism and peace and in a way, you know, hope and kind of love, like love for your fellow man, so that you're both willing to exchange goods, exchange ideas, in order to expand your consciousness, your mind, and yourself as a whole.
It is the great peacemaker. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what trade is. And I don't really like going the was it Bastiat who said if you stop. Once trade stops, armies come. I'm trying to remember the.
Let's see. Well, there's a misquoted quote by Bastiat. That's when goods don't cross borders, armies will. It's a great quote. Actually, Bastiat didn't say that. It's widely misattributed to him. His quote. He has a similar quote that's a little longer and less poetic. But that actually isn't a Bastiat quote. As much as I love it. But, well, yeah. Let's go with it anyway. When goods don't cross borders, armies will.
Well, no. It's funny though, right? Like if there's anyone who's going to be able to call me out for misquoting. Bastiat, it's definitely going to be you, seeing as how you help run the fucking thing. And that's why I'd like to have you on a show in order to be able to kind of expand people's minds on this specific topic, because it's more than just theory. Although, of course, theory it necessitates taking place in the real world. But it is fundamental to our understanding of people. You know. Voluntary exchanges of goods are generally a win-win situation. And just because one person benefits doesn't mean the other person has to lose. And creating this narrative of us versus them on a consistent basis is certainly a kind of a horrific idea. I'm not a America first above everyone else kind of guy. But I also think even if you do think America should be outstanding, then you should recognize that a reason why it was able to rise above and become this industrial giant was because it chose and the people chose to trade with other countries. And if that didn't happen, then you wouldn't have had the expansion you did. So trying to regress to a position of pure tribalism is contradictory to the notions of a lot of what you could call American Western values, you know? And I think that about sums it up. I just wanted to see if you had any more additional points you kind of wanted to let the audience know about.
So I'd just like to go into a little more of this concept of when goods don't cross borders, armies will. I think there's kind of two models of society that are very useful. And one of my favorite economists is Eleanor Ostrom. And she kind of describes a market-free society as a positive-sum game society, where humans have designed these games, these systems of norms and institutions that lead it to the point where interactions between people produce positive sums. And when you're in a world with different institutions than a market, such as North Korea, or just a very primitive society where there's small tribes that are constantly killing each other, you're in a zero-sum game system of social norms where the norms are a zero-sum game. If I win, you lose. You know, I conquer your land, you're dead, I win. Whereas a market is a positive-sum game where if I value, you know, your dollar more than my apple, I'll trade you my apple for your dollar. If you value my apple more than your dollar, you'll trade your dollar for my apple. And both of us are coming away with something better than we had going into it, or we never would have chosen to engage in the transaction in the first place. And this is the norm in positive sum game market societies. And when you look at this in an international context, it, I think, translates upward, where you have the relationship, say, between the U.S. and Russia is kind of a zero-sum game nowadays. There's not a lot of trade between the two countries, and it seems to be, oh, NATO will expand a little, which means Russia's losing. You know, Russia will march in somewhere, which means NATO's losing. But compare that to the relationship between the U.S. and China, which is very positive-sum game. Now, you still have tensions, you know, between the U.S. and China. We're nowhere near completely free market situation, but because there's so much trade and because it more closely resembles a positive sum game than a negative sum game, I think there's a very low chance of the US and China getting into a nuclear war that ends the species, at least comparative to the chance of the US and Russia getting into a nuclear war that ends the species. I think it's a lot more likely for the US and Russia to go to war because very small portions of our economies overlap. There's not a lot of trade, whereas the US and China have what some people have called mutually assured economic destruction, where the two economies are so intertwined that, like, the US can't really bomb out Chinese industry because it needs those factories just for its own war industry. The two structures of production are extremely intertwined. And you have that to a much lesser degree with Russia, which is why I think things like sanctions on Russia that have happened over the last couple years are extremely destructive, you know, just to the future of the human race continuing as a species, where you want the U.S. and Russia to be trading as much as possible if you don't want a nuclear war between the two, that this is always how history has worked. And when the U.S. puts sanctions on Russia to try and decrease the levels of trade with the U.S. and Russia, I don't care what how good the justification for those sanctions is, how awful Putin is. You know, if we want the species to keep on going, we should probably be against this.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's all I got.
All righty, sir. Well, thank you very much for being on the show. As always, where can people find more information from you? Of course, by the way, make sure that you check out our episode called Syrian Refugees, and that was part of our Islam series. And then Andrew was actually with me on another part of the Islam series, which was about kind of the history of British colonialism in Muslim territories. That for me was, you know, that was one of the most interesting bits of information that I think I've been able to kind of delve into and kind of show people in the libertarian realms just kind of how much the government plays a role in the rising of specific philosophies in different places for sometimes corrupt reasons and sometimes for what they think are good reasons, but overall have ended up being some of the worst policies that we've seen in hundreds of years. So definitely check those out. And yeah, so people can find you at the Bastiat Institute, right, on Facebook.
Yep, check out Bastiat Institute, Foundation for Economic Education, and Liberty Me. I'm affiliated with all those great organizations. Check them out. They've got a lot of great stuff on trade and Bastiat as well, if you want to learn more about him.
And I got to say, Liberty Me, the main thing that it's been good for is actually business connections. I've had a lot of people from, you know, media affiliates, things like that, who actually found me just through that. And they messaged me from there. And there's something about the filtering process of Liberty Me that's kind of great, where the majority of messages I get from people from there actually have proper grammar. So that's always kind of a lovely thing. But of course, guys, I recently got some questions about how do you donate to the show. And I just love the fact that I'm even being asked that question. I'm humbled by it that you know, people are able to get something out of the show. I mean, you know, some of the episodes have about 20,000 to 30,000 listeners, and it does cost money in order to be able to make the show, you know, bigger and to just have that amount of people downloading. So any small amount always helps. You can donate from, you know, $6 to $10 a month. If you go to libertarian-atheist.com/donate. And if you do that, that's really helps me out. I have a lot more equipment that I should be getting in here. I'm trying to build up a new studio in California. And when the government's taking away this amount of money, little donations, whether they be Bitcoin or cash, are always helpful. And of course, thank you so much to the people who are already donating to the show. It's a huge help. And it's also kind of a good reminder that people, you know, care about what I'm producing and giving to the world, because I think it's an important message and one that more people need to hear. And if you can't donate, that's totally fine. I understand. But please share the podcast and information I give out as much as possible. Of course, you can also find my book, Legally Kidnapped, The Case Against Child Protective Services, at legallykidnapped.net. You can also find that on Amazon. Book is doing pretty well, but I don't think enough people are reading it. And one of the ways I know that is because I am still getting messages constantly. CPS has been in my life. I didn't know what to do. And, you know, I didn't think that I was going to have to read your book before this because I didn't think CPS would come after me. And, you know, that's a tragic set of circumstances that I'm trying to prevent in more and more people's lives. So the more people who kind of hear the message of the truth about child protective services and how to protect yourself, the better. So, yeah. And for everyone who's already bought it and rated and reviewed it, thank you very much. And on that note, folks, I'd like to thank you all for listening. And Andrew, it's always fun. Let's talk again soon.
Definitely.